Don also gave me my chip. So I got my 25 chip. That's really not $25. 25 years. Yeah, I wouldn't sell it for $25. I'll tell you that. That's right. My name's John Allred, and I'm an alcoholic. That's fun. Every time my birthday falls on a weekend, it seems like I'm out talking someplace, and that's fun. I get to celebrate. I was in Memphis one time and picked up my, I think it was my 10-year chip in Memphis. It fell on a Sunday or a Saturday, and then I was in Canada one year, and I picked up my chip in Canada. So that's kind of fun. Thank you guys. This has been a great. Hasn't been great. Everybody had a good time.
Yeah.
I've had a great time, and I hope nobody takes this conference for granted, thinking that this just happens. And I want to thank the committee and John and Don for all the nice things they've done getting us out here, because this is a lot of work to put this on. Even though it's a nice little intimate group and it's a ball, it's a lot of work. And I hope none of us take it for granted, because it can disappear. You know, my home conference in Dallas, Texas was Lone Star Roundup. Big conference. 6 years ago, we had a little over 4,000 people at that conference. It was a great conference. That's just 5 years ago. 2 years later, there was no conference. It's done, you know? They went from that kind of deal to nothing and left a big hole, because it was every August, the third weekend of every August, and it just is not there anymore. And they've started a new one. They plan out next year, and we'll see how that goes. But things can disappear. We can't take AA for granted. You know, AA can go away. Conferences can go away. And so I hope we don't ever take that for granted. And the way you don't do that is you volunteer to be of service. You know, you get a hold of John or Don or somebody and say, hey, what can I do to help? What do you need stuff done? You need stuff cleaned up. You need food. You need, you know. And by doing that, the conference survives. Because it survives on the membership, not on just a couple people wanting to put on a party. And this has been a great weekend. I've had a ball, and I have no idea. We had a lot of workshops this afternoon. We're gonna have a great time tomorrow with question and answer period. I have a little disclosure I always put out, because I don't do AA really well. I'm not the best AA out there. I make no mistake about that. I don't speak very well at these things. And I love the meeting after the meeting, when you're not having coffee and you're trying to help another alcoholic who's usually not there. You know, you're just talking about him a little bit, you know, trying to help him out. You're sitting around talking about him, and somebody inevitably says, right, I love it. They'll say, oh, yeah, I know that guy. I know him. You know, he talks the talk, but he can't walk the walk, right? Who are we kidding? You know, none of us can walk the walk. I mean, if I could walk this walk, I wouldn't need to come to AA. I come to AA because I can't do it. I don't know how to walk the walk. That's why I come here. You know, and I think that's what the book says, doesn't the book say that? The book says when you start reading How It Works, chapter 5, you get through reading the 12 steps, what does it say? After the 12 steps, it says, what an order. Can't go through with it. Don't be discouraged, no one. So they don't exclude anybody. They don't exclude Bill Wilson. They don't exclude Dr. Bob. They certainly don't exclude John Allred. No one among us has been able to do anything like perfect adherence to these principles. Nobody can do this deal. Yeah. Yet those of us can't do it, like talking about the rest of you that can't. You know? Well, I don't do it better than he don't do it. You know? We just don't do this very well. And I wish we did. We don't even know what goes on in here. That's what's bizarre. I love Alcoholics Anonymous because it's such a paradox. You know, you come into AA and you're all fired up, and they say, now you got to change it. You got to change your whole life. Man, you want to change your playmates, change your playgrounds, change your playpens, change all that stuff. And you get a sponsor, and what's the first thing your sponsor says? Don't make any major changes the first year. You know? How are you going to do that? You know? And yet that's exactly what you have to do. You have to change everything without changing a thing. Now, that makes sense to me, you know? Normal people out there, doesn't make any sense. They say, what are you talking about? You know, but we don't know how do you do that? You know, don't know how to do that. We have, It's just bizarre. The paradox is here we are in here on Saturday night. Here's the paradox, man. All the drunks, all the Baptists are out there talking about the drunks. And all the drunks are in here talking about God. What a paradox. Don't go out tonight. Saturday night, the drunks are out there. We're in here talking about God. What a paradox that is, you know? It's just bizarre. And we don't know what goes on when we're in here, you know? But it always goes on. I tell you, what's funny? They say that the big deal now is, you know, they got a pill out. We were talking about this in the car. They got a pill out that takes away the craving. Takes away the cravings to drink alcohol. Now, the book says, you know, science may one day accomplish that. But as of yet, it hasn't. The book, now they've apparently accomplished it. It's got this pill you can take. I want to promise you something. They got that pill, and an alcoholic in this room will take it. You know? Help you drink like a normal drinker. Nobody's going to take that pill. What? You want to drink like a normal drinker? I don't know an alcoholic. I don't want to drink like a normal. You know how they drink? It's sick. I married a normal drinker. Sick. We're driving around. This is how a normal drinker drinks. We're driving around August in Dallas, Texas. Hot. You know, we got 25 days over 100. Hot. It's like Las Vegas. Y'all know how that is. And so we're driving around. She says, now she's normal. She drinks very little. But she says Saturday, she says, I want a beer. Can we stop and get a beer? I feel like a beer. I said, yeah, we can stop and get a beer. So we pull in there. Now, this is when we were dating. This is before we were married. And I said, you want to go in a joint and get a beer and sit down? She said, no, just get one for the road. I'll just drink it on the way going home. I just feel like a beer. So I stop at the beer joint and go in there and buy a bottle of beer. About a six-pack. I come out, waiting in the car. She looks at me and she says, what are you doing? I said, you wanted a beer. So I bought a beer. She said, you bought six. I said, I don't think they sell singles. Do they sell singles? Can you go in there and buy a bottle of beer? I don't think they do. I think the 12-pack or the quarts. That's it. I don't think they sell single bottles of beer. She said, you can buy a single pack. I said, well, I didn't know what to do that. So we go home, and she drinks her beer, and I guess she finished it. I don't know. And that was in August, Christmas time. It's Christmas. We're having a Christmas party at her place. And I'm over there, we're getting ready, and in the fridge, I notice there are four bottles of beer on the bottom shelf. And I said, honey, what is this beer doing on the bottom shelf? She said, well, that's the beer we bought. I said, in August? She said, yeah, Daddy wanted, he was up here, and he likes to have beer with his pizza, and we ordered a pizza while he was watching the football game, so he drank a beer. She'd got four left. You want to drink like that? You want to take a pill that would allow you to drink like that? And I don't want to drink like that. There's no way I want to drink like a normal person. That doesn't make any sense to my mind at all. So why am I going to take a pill that will allow me to do that? You know, I was sitting there, this is when I was single. A buddy of mine invited me over to his house. It's Sunday afternoon, I'm going to go over there, and we're going to... He wants me to meet this girl. It's a lineup deal. He's got this girl. So he and his wife, they're going to barbecue. They invite this girl over. They asked me to come over and meet him. They're not alcoholics. Nobody. I'm the only alcoholic there. So I go over there, and I walk in, and there Steve has one bucket of ice and a bottle of champagne in the bucket. And I said, what's this? He says, oh, that's the champagne. The girls wanted to have some mimosas this afternoon. They're gonna take the champagne, mix it with orange juice. Okay, I don't know why they do that, but they're gonna. So I said, they got one bottle of champagne. I said, how many bottles y'all got? He gets a funny look on his face and he says, just the one. Why? I said, hell, it's your party. I don't know. You gonna have one bottle of champagne? Yeah, it's fine. So we lay around the pool, we barbecue, we eat. Have a great afternoon. I'm getting ready to leave. It's about 6 o'clock. I'm leaving. They're all in the kitchen cleaning up, getting ready to go home. I notice all three of them gathered around this bucket of ice, fussing with this bucket. I said, what are y'all doing? Steve looks up and says, oh, John, you're an alcoholic. You don't know how to do this. How do we recork this bottle? I said, I don't have a clue how to recork that bottle. Anybody ever here had to recork a bottle? Hell, I'm embarrassed for these guys. Three of them all afternoon can't knock out one measly bottle of champagne. Three of them. I drank a 12-pack of Diet Coke in the meantime, you know? I couldn't believe it. I said, I don't have a clue how to do that, you know? I said, even if I would have bought champagne with a cork in it, I usually buy the easy screw-on cap, you know? If I'd have bought one with a cork in it, I'd have thrown that cork away. You don't need that cork, you know? You're not going to recork it. That's how normal. You want to drink like that? You want to nurse a bottle of champagne all Sunday afternoon? That makes no sense to me whatsoever. See, I like to drink to get drunk. That's what I do. And when I started drinking, I just got drunk. My first drunk, it was great. My child was born, and I hadn't been drinking. Didn't drink. I grew up in a very normal environment. My second child was born. I was 25 years old. Had my first drunk. Stuart called me up and invited me over to his place, and I had my first drunk. We went out to a place. This is Salt Lake City. So we went to a private club in Salt Lake City. You got to be a member of a private club doing a drink in Utah. So we went to this private club. It's called the Winery. It's right across from the Salt Palace. You walked down these steps, walked in there. Lights flashing, live band, women. Had a great drunk. It was a great drunk. Just drank whatever they put in front of me. I don't know what I drank. They bring a drink. It's dark. Dark drink. Got a twist around it going down there. I just drink it down. Next drink they bring is light. It's light colored drink. Got a cherry in it. I just drink it down. Whatever they, I don't know what I'm drinking. They're buying, I'm drinking. Some of them had salt around them. Around the lid, salt around them. I just drink it down. Whatever they buy, I'm drinking. Don't know. A lot of people know what they drank. I don't know. I'm just drinking. Had a great drunk. Got drunk that night. Danced. I want to tell you, I get a few drinks. I can dance. Michael Jackson and me we're cooking, you know, we can do that. Danced that night with two lesbians. I tell you, they're out there dancing together, you know. And I thought, they probably want me to join them. So I go out, and then they left together, and there I was alone, you know. But I learned something. I'm just drunk. When you're drunk, there's no rejection. You're just drunk. Got up, drank the next drink sitting in front of me. I'm okay. No rejection. Next morning, got up. Really felt pretty good. No hangover. A little tired. But I called up Stuart. I said, Stuart, I had a ball. He said, you did. You flat got after it. I said, do you think you're going to have a drink tonight? He said, I don't know. I'm probably going to stop and have one. I said, what time? He said, I got to work till 3 o'clock. I said, let's meet at 3:30. So I meet him at 3:30, got drunk again. So that's what I do. I get drunk. I don't like to have a drink. I never drank socially. I never got that cocktail or that glass of wine and walked around and chatted and was social. I never did that. I drink to get drunk. That's what I do. In fact, 3 weeks after that first drunk, I remember going to the liquor store at 10 in the morning because they open at 10. Okay, so I'm on time. I get there, go in. I buy three little mini bottles of vodka, those little bottles you get on the airplane, you know, because they tell me you can't smell vodka. So I buy three of those little mini bottles at 10 in the morning. I'd crack the lid on those bottles in my car, and I'd suck that down just as quick as I could. That's hard. Holes aren't that big in those little bottles. You get a hernia sucking on those puppies. You really will. I suck those down. Then I'd be okay to go to work. And I'm getting in trouble. My life's changing immediately. And they're telling me, you're drinking too much. You got a drinking problem. You're an alcoholic. As soon as they tell you're an alcoholic, man, you're screwed. Because there's no correct response to that accusation. You cannot say, am not. Because then they come back and say, you see, denial. First clue of alcoholism is denial. You're in denial. You're an alcoholic. You can't say, yeah, you're probably right, because then hell, you got to go to AA. So you can't deny or accept. You just got to, the best thing you can do is beat them to the punch and tell them they're alcoholics. So I'd get up in the morning, and my wife would look at me, and I'd say, honey, you're an alcoholic. She didn't even drink, you know. Let her deny it, you know. Let her deny that stuff. It's tough when they start telling you're an alcoholic. So I'd say, well, what's an alcoholic? What is that? What is an alcoholic? How do you know you're alcoholic? And so then they get real back off. Oh, settle down, John. Don't get excited. It's a disease. Okay? Then let's go find out. Let's go to the doctor. Let's get a proper diagnosis. I'm not going to take your word for this. I want a proper diagnosis. Well, we really can't do that. They sent me down to this guy named Jim Hale. He's dead now, so I can tell you. He was 46 years sober. That was 25 years ago. It was about 30 years ago. I go to see Jim Hale. And he was a sanity officer for the county. He also had 46 years sober. He's the one that signed the order when they committed you. I had to go down and see him every Saturday, see Jim Hale. And he'd tell me, I'm an alcoholic. I said, what's an alcoholic? And when I'd ask him that question, he'd tell me his story. I think, I didn't ask him how come he was alcoholic. I want to know, what's an alcoholic? He'd tell me his story. Had a great story. He was a lawyer. He's also a Catholic monk. Was on the Nuremberg trials. You know, served as one of the attorneys on the Nuremberg. Had a great story, but I'd heard it once, okay? I heard it the first night I asked him. He kept telling me every week, I got to hear about his story, you know? And I didn't know why he was telling me that. But I'd say, well, how can we go get a test? He said, no, we can't do that. So we can't go do that. We can't go get some blood analysis to find out I'm alcoholic. No, we can't do that. Now, I watch CSI. I know that they can do these blood tests. No, we can't do that. Well, how do you know you're alcoholic? Can't we go get like a CAT scan or MRI? No, can't do that. Well, how do you know you're alcoholic then? Oh, here's the deal. Y'all want me to quit drinking. Okay, what happens? 20 years now, I find out I'm not alcoholic. I've blown 20 years. I could have been drinking, you know? I'm not going to take that kind of risk. Just not going to take that kind of risk. So finally they say, well, you drink too much, right? You drink too much. You're alcoholic. You drink too much. As soon as they told me that, I know I'm not alcoholic. Because I never drank too much in my life. In fact, if you're alcoholic, there's not an alcoholic in this room that ever drank too much. It's impossible for an alcoholic to drink too much. Can't do it. See, I'm an alcoholic, but not because I drank too much. I'm an alcoholic because I couldn't drink enough. You ever drink enough? Well, yeah, I see somebody from this group. You go to the bar, you have a couple cocktails. Bartender says, you want another cocktail? Oh, golly, huh, Saturday night, huh, got church tomorrow, don't want to be late, think I've had enough, shit, never had enough, you know, I go to the bar at noon, you ever do that, you start drinking at noon, now it's midnight, been drinking 12 hours in the same bar, right, and I'm drunk, I know, I'm talking about it, I said, Stuart, God, I'm drunk, he says, me too. Can I buy another drink? So he hadn't had enough. Well, if you can't drink enough, it's impossible to drink too much. See, normal drinkers, you know who you are. Normal drinkers can drink enough. So occasionally, but not very often, they might drink too much. But if you're an alcoholic, like I'm an alcoholic, and you can't drink enough, it's impossible to drink too much. You'll never do it. That's why they don't understand it. Because they can drink enough, and they say, well, just have a few and then quit. I can't drink that way, because I can't drink enough. It's not I'm drinking too much. That's why they'll never understand me, and I'll never understand them. Because they can drink enough, I can't. I can't do it. In fact, when I drink, an incredible thing happens. It's like a little bomb that explodes inside of me. And man, it fills every empty pore I got. And I am happy, joyous, and free. And you want me to quit? Why would you quit when it does that for you? You ain't going to quit. In fact, when I drink, you know those promises in the book? Come after step 9, we got those promises after step 9. When I drink, those promises come true in my life. Without a doubt, every single time, guaranteed. I don't know about you, but after that first drink, I begin to know a new freedom and a new happiness every time. And you want me to quit. In fact, after 3 or 4 drinks, I don't know about you, but that fear of financial insecurity just kind of slips away. We don't need money. I got checks, you know. We're okay. After 7 or 8 drinks, I don't know about you, but I intuitively know how to handle situations that are baffling me. It's incredible how that works. After 8 or 9 drinks, I begin to comprehend the meaning of serenity. It's incredible how that works. After a dozen drinks or so, it becomes real clear that alcohol is doing for me what I can't do for myself. You know, and you want me to quit. Why would you quit when it's doing that for you? You ain't going to quit. In fact, here's the reality. When I came into AA and they read me those promises, I thought that was a really Mickey Mouse deal. Those promises meant nothing to me. when I was new. Because what I really wanted is a promise. You promised me that if I come in here and I don't drink and I do this bullshit you want me to do, I'm going to get a job. Okay, I need a job. I'm going to get a job. Somebody's going to give me a job. Somebody's going to give me a place to live. I'm going to get a car. I'm going to get a girlfriend to be nice. You know, those are promises that I really wanted. The reality is my whole life, I have insisted on having those promises in my life. I demand them. I want those. I will do anything to get those promises. Alcohol gave me the illusion of those promises. Every time. Works every time. Now, if I don't have a program that's going to give me those promises without drinking, I'm going to go drink to get them. Because it's that important to have those promises. I will do anything to get those promises, including drink. So I got to have a program of recovery that's going to give me those promises without drinking. Or I'm going to drink to get them. And the only program I know that does that is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they don't come until after step 9. So you can jack around with this all you want. You can not drink all you want, attend all the meetings you want to attend. But if you do not work the program and the steps, the clock is ticking and the time will come when you'll go drink to get those promises. Because you need them as bad as I do if you're an alcoholic. Because every one of those promises is what alcohol did for me when I'm drinking. Every one of them. You know, I didn't know any of that then. All I know is that I'm not quitting. It makes no sense for me to quit. Because it's working. It's really working for me. Now, I got problems. They said, okay, you want to know you're alcoholic? Take this little test. They give you that little test. Those 20 questions? 20 questions on that little test. Am I alcoholic? You know, I want you to know I can take that test and I can pass it non-alcoholic. I did it 3 times. Okay? Because I lie. Listen, I am so good at lying. I don't know I'm lying. Don't even know I'm lying. A lot of people call that denial. But I don't know I'm lying. And, I mean, they ask you, does alcohol cause you problems in your life? No. Alcohol, and I got a lot of problems. Alcohol's not one of them. Do alcohol cause you problems at home? No. And I got problems at home, but alcohol's not one of them. I got a problem with the wife. Okay, we should have talked about it before we got married, but we didn't. We just got married. It's philosophical. She thought that when you get married, she wanted to literally be married 7 days a week. All week long, she wants to be married. I don't want to be married that way. I kind of think you got to be married Monday through Friday. Separate Friday afternoon, party all weekend, go home Monday. That's kind of the way I wanted. She didn't want to be married that way. It's a bad problem. Alcohol doesn't do it. Okay? Does alcohol cause you problems at work? No. No, I got problems at work. Alcohol's not one of them. My boss, again, it was philosophical. He thought that when you work for him, he wanted you to work during the day. I'm a night person, really function better at night. I have a hard time getting there in the morning, but I'll make up for it. You know, no, he wanted me to work all day long. Bad problem. The alcohol caused you legal problems? No. No, I got legal problems. I don't know what I'd done to make him mad, but the cops were ticked. Because every time they see me, they arrest me. I mean, I can be doing nothing wrong. I can be walking out. I'm doing nothing wrong. I'm walking down the street. If a cop drives by, sees me, I go to jail. They had my picture and license plate on every dashboard in Salt Lake City. And they must have, because when they see me, I go to jail. I mean, I'm walking down the street one night. Okay. It was 3:30 in the morning. But you can walk down the streets of this country. It's a free country. 3:30 in the morning if you want to. Cop drove by, stopped, arrested me. I'll go to jail. Terrible. Terrible persecution. Profiled me. They must have profiled me. Okay, it was raining, but you can walk in the rain at 3:30. No reason for a cop to stop and pick you up. He did me. All right, I didn't have a shirt on. I was walking in the rain at 3:30 with no shirt, but that's not against the law. Did I lose that? Okay. You can do that at 3:30 in the morning. Cop girl, I asked the cop, why did you stop? As he's handcuffing me. Okay, I had a gash in my head. I had blood running down my head. That was not my fault. I'd been in a cab earlier. I told that cab driver, stop, I want to get out. That cab driver did not stop quick enough for me. I got out of that moving cab, hit my head on the ground. That's when I ripped my shirt. And I had blood running down my head, took my shirt off. And the cop said, I stopped to see if you're okay. You had blood running down your head, no shirt, walking in the rain at 3:30. Then he found out who I was, arrested me. So they got these things. Now, this is not fair. This is not fair at all. I'm fixing to write a letter about it, okay? Because they got these things on, they got these computers now, and they got these things, I don't know if they got them in Nevada or not, but they put them on those computers, and now they put the computers in the cop car. That's not fair. That's not fair. They put these things on that computer. They put the computer in the cop car. They're called warrants. They put these warrants out for it. They didn't bother come looking anymore. They just put out a warrant on a computer and then wait for us to show up, you know? And we always do. We always show up. I say, yeah, got your warrant here. That warrant's 3 years old. Yeah, it sure is, but it's a warrant. Right here, got you. You're going in. So I go to jail. And so I got a timing problem. Most alcoholics got a bad timing problem. Your timing's off. And that's the worst problem you have. Because when your timing is off, you don't know whether you're ahead of schedule or behind schedule. So you don't know whether to speed up or slow down. So, I mean, I'd get arrested and I'd think, son of a bitch. If I'd have just been 1 minute later, that cop would not have been at that intersection, and I would have been through there, and I'd have been okay. And then I thought, well, maybe I should have been 1 minute earlier. And then I'd have beat him to the intersection, and I'd have been okay. The cop would not have been there, and I'd have been okay. Just by a minute, my timing was off. So, I mean, I'm sitting at the bar, and I'm thinking, I wonder if it's time for me to go, you know? Bad timing. Timing was just off all the time. Finally, I figured out my real problem. My brother told me, they said, you better straight up and fly right because the folks think you're crazy. They're going to lock you up, commit you. And they got the judge ready to sign the commitment papers. They're going to sign the commitment papers. Jim Hale's going to sign the commitment papers. They're going to commit you. And that's when I figured out my real problem. Utah, okay, is at a high altitude. I mean, it's in the mountains. It's high altitude in the mountains. Scientific fact, people who live at high altitudes for a prolonged period of time have thinner blood than people who live at low altitudes. Well, I've been living in Utah my whole life. I got to have thin blood. You go out and you party hard on thin blood, you have a problem. What I need to do is get to sea level, thicken up my blood, and I'd be able to drink okay. So I called a buddy, lives in Seattle, that sea level. Told him about these problems I had. He said, man, take a year off, come up here. I said, I want to impose on you and Gail, your five kids. He said, no imposition. So I said, I'll be there Tuesday. So I moved to Seattle, sea level. Not doing anything, just doing a little drinking and working on thickening up my blood. And the next logical thing you want to do when you're in that condition is how you're going to want to gamble. You know, best time to gamble is when you're unemployed. So I started gambling up there, started playing poker. They had poker houses up there. I started playing poker, and then I thought, who am I kidding? I started running down to Nevada, playing out here in Las Vegas and Reno, and I thought, I'm just going to move to Nevada. That's where the real that's lower than sea level. You get real thick blood down there in Nevada. So I moved down here to Nevada, bounced around Las Vegas, ended up in Reno, Tahoe area. Wasn't doing anything, just doing a little drinking, playing a little poker, working on thickening up my blood. Buddy invited me back over to Salt Lake. Shouldn't have gone back over there that weekend. High out to drink will get me in trouble. But I go over there, and we start out on Friday night at the One More Time Club. It's a great club. And met her, fell in love, wanted to take her out Saturday. Couldn't go out Saturday. She couldn't go out Sunday. Had to stay until Monday. Take this girl. Supposed to go home Sunday. Should have gone home Sunday. Stayed till Monday to take her out. It's a bad date. Terrible date. You know you got a bad date when you invite them to dinner and then they really want to eat. You know? So I never eat when I drink. So she's eating, I'm drinking. But I'm a gentleman, sure, time ordering me a whiskey or her a glass of wine. Well, the woman is busy eating. She ain't keeping up. Her wine's stacking up. Now, to keep from being embarrassed, I got to drink my whiskey and drink her wine. It was just a bad date. And she wanted me to take her home. I want to take her home. Dropped her off 10:30. Went over to Price. That was October 6, 1981. So I said, now tomorrow, October 7, 1981, we're going to hit this town one more time. Then I'm out of here. This half a drink will get me in trouble. So we got drinking on Tuesday, October 7, 1981. We started drinking at the Joker Club. The Joker Club wasn't a private club. It was just a little 3-2 beer bar. I'll be honest about the Joker Club. It was a topless joint. I want a very fancy topless. They had one dancer in the whole place. And you had to be drunk to appreciate her. I mean, it was just sad. Sad. And so we started drinking there, and then we went over to see the fashion show at the Hilton. Excuse me. I remember the fashion show, and then I blacked out. I black out a lot. Some blackouts are a little scary. Some aren't too bad. There are two factors that determine how scary a blackout is. The first factor is how long are you blacked out? The longer you're blacked out, the more scary a blackout is. The second factor is what are you doing when you come out of your blackout? That also contributes to how scary they are. And I wasn't blacked out that long, maybe a couple hours. But I came out of my blackout at the worst time. the worst time to come out of a blackout. Those of you that black out know that the worst time to come out of a blackout is when you're talking to the cops. Okay? Because you don't have a clue where you are in the conversation. You really don't. And you can't ask. You can't say, now what are we talking about here? You can't say that. You gotta figure out, what have I told them? What have they asked me? What have I responded to? You know, without ever asking them that. And it's very difficult time. And I finally figured out that one of my driver's license, didn't have a driver's license. They'd taken that three DWIs earlier. And I said, well, listen, I'm glad you stopped, but I'm going over there. I'm going to leave my car parked here. That's where I'm going. I'm going to go right over there. I'm going to walk over there. That's probably where my driver's license is, right over there. And I'll come back and pick my car up in the morning. They would not let me go. Get me there. Finally ran my license plate, found out who it was, arrested me. I'm in lockup. Don't like lockup. Don't like nothing about lockup. But this time they're really ticked, because I can't even bond out. Can't even bond out. See, I knew the system. You get arrested, you plead not guilty, right? Not guilty. And then if it's just drunk stuff, you go to the OR. You get out of your OR back in the 70s and early 80s. No big deal. It's a misdemeanor. And then you get your attorney. They set the court date, and you start that famous postponing process, right? You postpone, postpone, postpone. You just keep postponing. What you're doing is you're hoping the cop dies. That's what you really want that to happen, you know? And they never do. Mine always showed up. And then you want to be sure when the attorney tells you, now tomorrow we postpone this thing for 9 months or a year. Tomorrow we go to court. No excuse. No more postponing. We go to court tomorrow. You want to be sure the day before court, move. Okay? Because that's what I did. I just moved. I never went to court. Just moved. And so I had all these failure to appears. So they said, no, we're not letting you. You don't come back. So you're going to court. So I'm in lockup. Can't get out. Finally, a buddy of mine named Stan. Stan comes down to see me. Stan wasn't an alcoholic, didn't know anything about AA or alcoholism, but a very dear friend, had a lot of money, a lot of influence in Salt Lake. And he said, I've talked to some friends, I can get you out. But the only way they'll let you out is if you commit to me, you go to treatment, because you're sick and you need help. You're in my custody. And I said, oh, Stan, bless you. You are so right. Man, I don't know what it is. I go down there and I get drunk in these bars. I get in all kinds of trouble, and I don't want to do that. I guess I'm an alcoholic. I need help. But I can't get any in here. He says, I'll get you out. So I get out of jail. Now, I had no intention of not drinking. I didn't want to quit. I'm not going to quit. I'm just getting out of jail. And I will do or say anything to get out of jail. So I got out of jail. I had to stay with Stan that night. Next day, we get up. He throws in the Yellow Pages. Says, you can go anywhere you want to go, but you got to go to treatment. So I look in the Yellow Pages. A lot of treatment centers in 81. I called the first treatment center, top of the book, and I said, I need to come in for a little treatment. Gal says, do you have any insurance? I said, no, hadn't worked for 3.5 years, and I don't have any insurance. She says, well, it's like $12,000 back in 81. I said, I'm not that sick. You know, don't you have a little treatment? She said, that is a little treatment. Couldn't believe it. It was very fresh. I come to this one place. They wanted $18,000 at this one place. I was so frustrated. I said, honey, listen, if I had $18,000, I wouldn't need your damn treatment. Would have solved anything I had right there. Very frustrating. I come to this one joint. And I said, I need to come in for some treatment. Girl says, okay. So how much is it? She says, she's a salesperson. So she's going to give me benefits first. She says, well, you get room, board, and therapy. They have both individual therapy with one of our certified counselors and group therapy conducted by one of our certified counselors, and it was $9 a day. And then when you check in, we apply for food stamps, to credit the food stamps to the bill. And if you work around here, we get some state aid. We pay $1.50 a day, which you can buy cigarettes with, or you could apply it to the bill. Cigarettes were $1.35 a pack out of the vending machine. And if you do all that, it brings down to about $5 a day. I couldn't believe it. I asked her, I said, how long is your waiting list? So there's other places that wanted 12, 18,000. They had 30 to 60-day waiting list just to get in. I said, how long is your waiting list? And she said, well, we have a bed for you tonight. I said, well, hell, I don't need to come tonight, you know? She says, I think you ought to come tonight. And I got a problem with this place. Think about it. They got bargain rates, $9 a day, room, board, and therapy. They can't fill their beds. Now, they're high-pressuring me to get me to come in. Okay, I'm the consumer here. I got my rights. I said, honey, listen, you make my reservation for Saturday or just forget the whole damn deal. So she made them for Saturday. I didn't drink. hung out with Stan. Don't know why I didn't drink, just didn't drink. Probably because I was hanging out with Stan. Saturday comes, I drove down there, parking in the park. I sat in that parking lot all day, watching him go in and out of there, in and out. I wanted to see, you know, what kind of person goes to a $9 day jitter joint, you know? So I watched him go in and out of there. Those guys going in there were alcoholics. You could tell looking at that guy, he needs to go there. Look at that guy. He needs to be in there. He's an alcoholic. You can tell looking at that guy, he's alcoholic. They don't look like y'all look. Y'all do not look like alcoholics. Guys going in there look like alcoholics. And I was an alcoholic, but it fit my budget, so I checked in. I got in there and filled out a bunch of papers. Got my rooms, nice place, clean place. That was on Saturday. Sunday, I had my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. Two guys from outside came in and chaired the meeting. We sat around lunch tables and lunch. 36 of us, all men, sat around lunch tables. And these two guys talked for a long time. Didn't listen to a thing they said. Don't know anything they said. Listened to them. And I'm watching everybody else. See how everybody else does AA. Because I'm a real chameleon, right? I'm going to go there. I'm going to watch what everybody does. And I'm going to fit. I'm going to blend. I'm going to do what I need to do to fit. So I'm watching everybody else. These two guys got through talking. There was a discussion meeting. So they went down the rows. The first guy introduced himself. Said, my name's Joe B. I'm an alcoholic. I'll pass. Second guy said, my name's Jim S. I'm an alcoholic. I'll pass. I caught on real quick. What they do in AA, they give their first name, last initial, admit to the group they're alcoholics, and then pass. There's got to be something magical about admitting to this group you're alcoholic. They'll just take that burden of alcoholism off your shoulders. So that must be the deal, because they had it written on the wall, admitted you're powerless over alcohol. So that must be what they do here. So it got to me. I did it right. I said, my name is John A. I'm an alcoholic, and I'll pass. Nothing happened. Not a damn thing happened. As it became obvious, I guess I'm not alcoholic, you know? And if I am, if I do have a little bit of alcoholism in me, Alcoholics Anonymous must be for real stupid people, you know? Not for anybody with any brains like I've got, certainly. It's just for stupid-minded, simple, stupid people. That's what AA is. Now, as distorted perception, that is Alcoholics Anonymous, that is my perception of AA. It ain't me, besides I'm an alcoholic anyway. That was on Sunday. Monday, I got me my counselor, Dale, lovely lady. Spent an hour with Dale in my private consultation. She wanted me to stay there 2 months. 2 months. I said, Dale. I've been here all weekend, okay? I've been talking to these guys. They've told me they're alcoholics. They are. I have no reason to doubt them. They look like they probably are alcoholics, okay? I don't know whether I'm an alcoholic or not, but I just can't stay 2 months. I said, they've been telling me how... she said, you can't stay 2 months? I said, no, I'm busy. I can't stay 2 months. I'm too busy. She looks through her papers and says, now, where are you working? Well, I'm not working, but I'm busy. Isn't that true about us? Alcoholics, the most busy, you know, unemployed people you ever want to meet in your life. Go to the meeting Monday, right? And it's a work day. Monday's a work day. Go there and watch the guy at your meeting. He's got nothing to do all day long but get to the meeting, and he's late. Ask him, say, where have you been? Oh, hell, I've been busy. You know, I don't know what we do, but we're busy doing it. We really are. So I said, you know, so you give me whatever you're going to study during that 2 month period. Okay? I'll read ahead. You know, you can give me, you know, whatever pop quiz you want to do. Because 2 weeks I'm out of here. She looks at it and she says, well, she better hurry with you. I said, damn right, you better hurry with me. So that was on Monday. Tuesday, I got to go to group therapy, love group therapy. Wednesday's alcoholic education seminar. They're showing a movie about drug addiction and alcoholism. They're boring to me. Even today, they're boring. So I'm sitting there watching this movie, prepared not to like it. And the name of their movie they're showing was I'll Quit Tomorrow. So I'm watching this movie, and it tore me up. Couldn't believe it. It's like they made a movie. I related to everything in that movie. It's like they made a movie of my life, and they were showing it to the group. I didn't even that guy. I dressed the way that guy dressed. I talked the way he talked. I acted the way he acted. I drank. I drank the way that guy drank. I related to everything in that movie. And I knew the gig was up. That was my moment of clarity. I'm watching there, and I related to that. I knew the gig was up. That's me. They made a movie of my life. You know? What happened to me that night is I quit looking for that definition. What's an alcoholic? How do you know you're an alcoholic? What is an alcoholic? I later found out in AA, see, we don't have a definition of an alcoholic. I couldn't define an alcoholic for you tonight. What we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is a description of an alcoholic. You can't argue with the description. Hell, you can argue with the definition, right? So Webster's got 10 definitions for every word, right? But you can't argue with the description. The most powerful tool we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is our description of the alcoholic. Because it's that description as the alcoholic relates to it that seems to have the power to literally strip everything that separates the alcoholic from himself. And I could see me that night like my mom saw me. I could see me that night like my ex-wife saw me. The difference was I could see me as I related to it. And I knew the gig was up. It's the most important tool we have is our description. That's why we tell our, that's why Jim Hale was telling me his story when I'd ask him, what's an alcoholic? And he'd tell me his story. Didn't relate to it then. You know? It's the most important tool we have in AA is our description of the alcoholic. And that's why our book, 2/3 of our book, is what? Descriptions of alcoholics in the stories. Why'd they put all those stories in there? Just to make a big book? You know? No, it's that important because that description is the alcoholic relates to it. And they told me when they get, when I got the book, your story's in here. Read it till you find your story. You know? Because you'll relate to some story in here. Your story's in this book. It's that important. And I wasn't happy about that. That moment of clarity I had, I wasn't happy about it. Sometimes you'll hear from the podium people stand up and say how relieved they were to know what their problem was and that they were alcoholics and how much they felt at home in AA. What a great burden it was off there. That was not my experience. I was ticked and I was scared and I cried all night. My whole life just changed that night. I mean, God, I'm an alcoholic. Everything's done now. Everything's changed. I'm an alcoholic. I know I'm an alcoholic. I got to change it. I got to get a job. You know? How am I going to meet people? I cried all night. How am I going to meet people and function in a world that scares me to death? I'm an alcoholic. I can't drink. God, my whole life just changed. I cried all night. And I stayed there 6 weeks. Couldn't stay 2 months. Busy. Too busy. But I stayed 6 weeks. I got out of there. They said, now, John, you need aftercare. A very important part of recovery is your aftercare. So you're going to go to aftercare. But you can't come back here 3 times a week for aftercare. That's 800 miles from Reno to Salt Lake. So you go to AA for your aftercare. Here's Intergroup's phone number. When you get back to Reno, call Intergroup, ask them, and go to meetings for your aftercare. So I drove back to Reno. I knew 2 things when I drove back there. I know I'm an alcoholic. I don't want to drink. I know that for a fact. Second thing was, I know AA has nothing to offer. I mean, because you go there, you give your first name, last initial, admit you're alcoholic, and then pass. You know, big deal. I don't know why we got to keep doing that. I've been there, done that, got the baseball cap and T-shirt. Don't need to do it anymore. But I don't want to drink. So when I got back in Reno, December 2nd, actually, I knew 2 things. I called, first day I'm back in town, I call Intergroup, phone number they got me, because I don't want to drink. AA is not the solution, but I don't want to drink. So I call AA, guy answers the phone. I tell him, I said, my name's John A. I'm an alcoholic. He said, well, I'm Bruce. I'm an alcoholic. What are you going to do for it, John? And I said, well, I just got a treatment over in Salt Lake City. I'm living here in Reno, Nevada. And I, you know, wanted to call and check in. You know, I guess they thought, man, had me on computer, you know. You got to check in and they put you on a failure to appear list and then you're screwed. So I called to check in. He said, I'm glad you're here. You want to go to a meeting tonight? It was Thursday night. I said, yeah, I can go to a meeting. You'll probably want to meet me. He said, I'm not going to go, but there's a men's stag at the Hotel Riverside Casino, third floor Sierra room. Starts at 8:30. And I said, I don't know where it is. 8:30 is good. I can be there. I'll be there a little early so we can meet. He said, well, I'm not going. I said, well, call them, you know, and let them know that John A. is, you know, coming to their meeting tonight. He said, don't worry about it. There'll be some men there for you. So I show up 20 after 8. First resentment, Alcoholics Anonymous. The guy did not call him, tell him I'm coming. I made a reservation. Nobody there. Say, oh, you must be John A. Here's your chair. Here's your coffee. No, there's just some guys smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee. Waiting for the meeting. I got my coffee, sat down. Pretty soon, an old guy named Red got up to chair of the meeting. Red looked like an alcoholic. Talked for a long time. Didn't listen to a thing Red said because I'm watching everybody else. How do they do AA in Reno? Trying to figure out how they do it. These guys did it the same way they did in treatment. They just smoked cigarettes, drank coffee. Didn't pay a bit of attention to Red either. So he got through talking. They started down the row. There's a discussion meeting. These guys didn't pass. They were talking. Now, I don't know what they were talking about. You know, nothing we talk about. But these guys couldn't even introduce themselves right. They really couldn't. Some of them did not give their last initial. They said, my name's John, I'm an alcoholic. You're supposed to give your last initial. Guy didn't give his last initial. You're supposed to do that. So, John A. You know, some of them gave their last name. They said, my name's John Allred, I'm an alcoholic. I thought, Jesus. What does he think anonymous means, man? Unbelievable. So I thought, you know what? If he's not going to respect his anonymity, I will. I'm going to look at the guy. I'm going to look at the guy. Don't know who he is. Don't think about the guy. If I see this guy on the street, I'm not even going to say hi to him because we're anonymous. Anonymous program. And they're talking about, I don't know what they're talking about. It's nothing we talk about. I sat half through that meeting. Nobody mentioned we got an XY chromosome deficiency. It became real clear. These guys have not been to treatment. Okay? So when it finally got to me, I thought I'd help. I did it right, too. I said, my name is John A., and I'm an alcoholic. And then I qualified. I said, listen, guys, I just got a treatment over in Salt Lake City. I want you to know I got the latest, most up-to-date medical and psychological information on the disease of alcoholism. Second resentment, Red cut me off, said, thank you, John. Went on the next guy. son of a bitch is jealous, you know? I know stuff about the disease he don't know. That's his problem. Asked me, some guys come, shook my hand. They said, we hope you come back. I'll be back. They need me. They need me down here, you know? Now, Chuck Chamberlain used to always say, every man's my teacher. Some people teach me what to do. Some people teach me what not to do, right? Most of what I share is what not to do, okay? Because I've done this deal all wrong. I don't know where I was when they said 90 meetings in 90 days. I didn't do that. I do one meeting a week. Every Thursday, I'm down at my men's stack. Now, they will not let me share. But I keep going back. I figure, you know, I'm a hell of a lot younger than Red. He's going to die. Then I get to share. You know? Now, let me tell you what happens when we go to one meeting a week if you haven't done that. One of the things they told me in treatment, which is true, it's true. They said, John, don't drink, okay? If you don't drink, you'll feel better. And that's true. You will. But see, they didn't explain what that meant. If you don't drink, you will feel better. You're going to feel everything better. You're going to feel all the pain, all the anger, all the resentment. You're going to feel that shit a whole lot better, you know? And that's when I drink is when I feel. I don't want to feel better. I drink when I feel better. That stuff comes up, you know? So I'm walking around Reno feeling better, going nuts. Crazy. I mean, sobriety is like watching paint dry. It's just, oh, God, it's Thursday. We get to go to Men's Stag again. Good. Not share. One more time. So I'm down there. It was Christmas Eve. It was Christmas Eve, a men's stag meeting, and they said, now tomorrow's Christmas Day. Those you got nowhere to go, you can go to the Dryers Club. Skid Row Clubhouse on Wells, still there. Go over there for free Christmas dinner. It's good. I had nowhere to go Christmas Day, so I went over to the Dryers Club, found it. Ate. It was good. I'm sitting there not bothering a soul, smoking a cigarette, drinking a cup of coffee. Old timer caught me. You can tell those old timers when they spy a newcomer, man, their eyes kind of glaze over. They start to salivate, and they go, newcomer. And I looked at him, he got up, started walking over toward me, and I thought, oh, look at this guy. He's not my kind of guy. I like cool guys. This guy's not cool. Nothing cool about him. He's an old guy. Fat old guy. Big nose, real funny hair. Nothing. I like cool guys. This guy's not cool. Here's coming up. So look at this guy here. He's coming over to talk to me. What's he doing? I don't want to talk to this guy. He comes over, introduces himself. His name's Don. We're talking. He informs me that he's the coordinator of intergroup. I don't know what that is, but I thought, well, I'm glad they found something for you to do. You know? So we're talking, and it became real clear to me after just a few minutes. It became clear Don had not been to treatment. So I start telling Don about all the stuff that I'm going to talk about in my home group. He gets a funny look on his face, and he says, John, would you like to go to a meeting with me tonight? And I said, well, hell, Don, it's Friday. I go Thursdays over to men's stag meeting. He says, we got a meeting every night in Reno. At that time, we had 37 meetings in a week in Reno. And he said, we had a meeting every night in Reno. Come go with me. And I'd heard in that month I'd been going to AA, I'd heard that this is a spiritual program, right? Spiritual program, AA. It's Christmas, okay? It's Christmas. I can go twice this week. It won't hurt. You know? So Don comes, gets me. We go out to State Hospital. We got State Hospital Friday night. They got a meeting at 7 o'clock out at State Hospital. We get there, and they give you a raffle ticket when you walk in. You get a raffle ticket, and they raffle off a big book, or it's bill season, right? So you get my raffle ticket, walk into the meeting. And the women in that meeting, first meeting I've been to with women in the meeting. I didn't know they let them in. I really didn't. I've been to Minister Out Joint, Men's Stag meeting. I got women in the meeting. I couldn't believe it. Millie adopted that as my home group. I thought, Jesus, why am I going Thursday when I come here Friday, man? I'm coming back here Friday. This is my new home group, baby. This is it. I'm coming back here Friday. I got my raffle ticket, sat down. They had a meeting. I don't know what they talked about because I'm busy praying. Because they'll have a great mind and I read real fast. Okay, I had forgot to get a big book. Now, this is it, man. It's Christmas Day. I'm probably the only guy in this meeting without a big book. I'm winning the book. God, this is going to be God's gift to me this Christmas. I'm winning that. It's going to be a gift from God to John A. I'm winning that book. So I'm praying hard for that book. By the time that meeting's over, nobody's been praying like I've been praying. I want the book. Book's mine. And the meeting they had the raffle, third resentment in AA. Some little gray lady, 25 years sober, wins my book. What's she doing winning my book? She got five at home collecting dust. She can't even see the woman so old winning my book. So I'm storming out of there. Before I get out of there, that little lady comes up and gives me that book. Unless I got my big book. And that really wasn't the Christmas gift I got that year. And I took that book home that night, and I used to say that I read that book from cover to cover. So if you ever heard me say that, I know a lot of you are tired of this story, but if you ever heard me say that, or if you ever get a hold of an old tape where I said that on the tape, please believe me that when I said that, hell, I believed it, you know. And then I got involved in a big book study. You wouldn't read the chapters in that book. They got a chapter in the book, Chapter to the Wives, you know. Well, I didn't have a wife, didn't want a wife. Wasn't a wife. Didn't read that chapter, okay. They got a chapter in the book, Chapter to the Employer. Hell, I'm not an employee. Didn't read that chapter, okay. They got a chapter in the book, We Agnostics. I wasn't agnostic. I knew God real well. Didn't read that chapter. Well, if you just read, you know, chapter 3 and chapter 5, you can read that book, and it won't take that long to do it. Really won't. Next day, Don calls me up, takes me to another meeting. Every day, this guy's calling me, taking me to a meeting. And I don't want to go, but he doesn't ask. He just calls and says, I'll pick up in 20 minutes. Click. I thought, how does he know I'm going to a meeting? I don't want to go to a meeting. I'm not going to go to a meeting tonight. I went to a meeting last night. I'm not going to a meeting tonight. And then I think, wait a minute, you know what? He's the only guy talking to me in AA. If I don't go, what's he going to say about me behind my back? Hell, I got to go to a meeting. I got to go to a meeting. So this guy's taking me to a meeting. Taking me to a meeting. Interesting thing happened. That time I hadn't worked any steps, didn't have a sponsor, nothing. The only change in my life is a meeting every single day. And a fascinating thing happened. I not only feel better, but I feel good. And I hadn't felt those two things at the same time in years. And all of a sudden, sobriety started to put on flesh and bones. And I started meeting other guys in AA, you know. I started getting excited to go see them. And I started hanging out in a group during the day, drinking coffee, talking to Don and Pete. Pete Tyrene down. He's dead. He's passed on now. And I talked to those guys down there, and I started to look forward to it. And it was embarrassing. I felt like a little kid, you know. Don would come get me. I'd get in his car, and he's driving. We're going to the meeting. And I remember sitting there feeling like a little kid. And I'd say, Don, do you think we can go get ice cream tonight? We'll see. It's a whole new world to me, you know? And I'm starting to meet these guys. I'm starting to get excited about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm starting to look forward to going to those meetings. I'm down in intergroup during the day. I'm down there a week later. It was Thursday. It was New Year's Eve. I'm in intergroup. I'm pumped up about AA, man. I'm going to meetings every day. And the phone rings intergroup. New Year's Eve. Week later, I grabbed the phone, intergroup, answered the phone. It was a young kid named Glenn. Glenn, 17 years old, wanted out to stay sober New Year's Eve. I said, why? I mean, damn, Glenn, it's New Year's Eve. You know, call tomorrow. We're here 24, you know, we'll be here tomorrow. No big deal. Don grabbed that phone away from me. That's when he passed the law, the rule of central office. You must have 6 months sobriety to answer this phone. Put a big sign up there. Must have 6 months sobriety to answer the phone, you know. So Don talked to me for a while. It was my fourth resentment in AA. Gave me his phone number, did not give him my phone number. But the next day, Don calls me up and says, hey, Glenn stayed sober last night, wants to go to a meeting today. I thought, great, my first 12-step call. So Don comes, gets me. We go pick up Glenn. He's sober one day. Take Glenn out to the meeting. I stay at hospital. I got my big book. We're driving the car. And damn it, Don is not preparing Glenn for AA. He's just taking him to a meeting. I thought, hell, I got to do it all. I just got to do it all. So I start telling Glenn all about AA. I said, Glenn, you're going to love this, man. You get, I didn't know they're there for 2 months, but you get women your first meeting. We're going to have women here this meeting. And I've been to several groups in Reno since I've been sober. And this group has the best looking women. You want to come back here? You and I will come to this meeting next Friday night also. This would be the best group for you to come to. This is a great meeting to get women there. And when you get there, Glenn, they're going to give you a raffle ticket when you first get there. Hang on that raffle ticket. Because at the end of the meeting, they're going to raffle off the big book, or as Bill sees it. And if God loves you, you'll win the book. Don just drove to the meeting. So we get to the meeting, walk in there, and we get our raffle tickets. I don't know what they talked about because I'm busy praying for Glenn. Come on, God, let Glenn. If Glenn can win that book, just let God win the book. After I've prepared him like I have, that is going to be proof, you know, that God is working in his life. And Glenn will stay sober forever. If he can just win that book, God, let him win that book. He'll stay sober. And then, of course, not that it matters, but, you know, I would have 100% 12-step call success rate. I'll be able to write articles in the grapevine, how to have 100% 12-step call success rate. It'll just be wonderful. So we're playing all me. Finally, at the end of the meeting, we have the raffle off the big book. I won the book. Don turned to me and said, see how that works? I said, yeah, I signed it, gave it to Glenn. That's where Glenn got his book. Okay, Glenn's sober today because I gave him that book. That's why he's sober today. Now, that little experience early in my sobriety taught me everything about AA. Taught me a lot about God. Taught me how God works. See, God works through people. That's how God works. He works through people. See, by working through people, whenever God works, it becomes a win-win situation. Always two winners when God works. It's a win-win deal with God. Got to be a win-win deal. Okay? Always two winners when God works. So I could have won the big book the first night. There'd been one winner, me. But that little lady won by being able to share with me, and I won by being able to receive from her. A week later, two winners. I won by sharing with Glenn, and Glenn won by being received from me. God works through people. See, by working through people, God gets twice the result for the same effort. Very efficient God. Very efficient God. God works through people. It also taught me how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Alcoholics Anonymous is one drunk sharing with another. That's the meat of our program, guys. One alcoholic sharing with another. Whenever that happens, there are two winners. The drunk doing the sharing, the drunk doing the receiving. Okay? See, I've told that story in 25 years. I don't know, 1,000, maybe more than 1,000 times. And every time I tell that story, I remember that moment of clarity. I'm sitting there watching that movie, and I know the gig is up. I'm convinced that all of us here in AA tonight that are sober have had that moment of clarity. When you knew the gig was up. Okay? I'm equally convinced that those that come to AA for a while and leave and out there drinking and dying tonight had that moment of clarity when they knew the gig was up. What's the difference between those of us that are sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and those of us that are out there drinking and dying tonight? We both had that moment of clarity. I think what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is really pretty simple. What we do in here is we keep that moment alive. We keep it alive. Okay? See, as I shared my moment with you, what are you thinking about? And when one of y'all is on this side of the podium, and I'm on that side of the podium, and you're remembering your moment of what it was like and what happened, and you're keeping your moment alive. By the way, this is the perfect program for people whose root problem is they're selfish, self-centered. Because when you're up here and you're remembering your moment, I'm so selfish, self-centered, what am I thinking about? My moment, as I relate to it. Screw your deal. I did that, you know. We keep it alive. And nowhere can you keep that moment alive but when one alcoholic shares with another. You can't keep your moment alive by sharing with your doctor. They don't need to hear it. You know, my life depends on hearing about your moment so that my moment stays alive. You can't keep your moment alive by sharing with your therapist. It's not a win-win deal. They don't need to hear it. My life depends on hearing it so that my moment stays alive. Because what happens when you lose your moment? You take drunk. And it's that moment that's God's gift. That's the gift that God gives us. All we do in AA is keep it alive. But the moment of clarity is what God gives us, free. And that gift from God usually takes place before you get to AA. We've assumed you've had that when you get here. Because all we're going to do is keep the moment alive. And the proof of that statement is your last drink. I'm willing to bet a whole lot of money. When you had your last drink, and you sat it down, you had no idea that was your last drink. No clue. What happened? Divine intervention. I want to know about that. Because hearing about what happened to you is going to keep my mom alive about what happened to me. And it happens, that gift of God happens to us before we get here. It's incredible. The miracle of that whole experience of how we got here. That's why we share it in these meetings. Because we keep it alive when we share it. Because what happens when you lose your moment? You take drunk. You take drunk. But in here, we keep that moment alive. And it's a miracle that it happens. And you can't explain how that happens, how that works. That's why you can't explain AA. You know? We try, but we can't explain it. What happened? You'll go Monday. You go to work Monday, and they say, have a good weekend. Oh, I had a great weekend. What'd you do? Well, I went to this little roundup, you know, a little retreat for active in AA, you know. Really? Yeah. Was it good? Oh, man, a guy down there, he was doing good, man. He was doing really good. Then he got drunk, man. He got drunk. He lost his wife. He lost his house, lost his business, lost his family, lived outdoors, went to the penitentiary, spent 2 years in the penitentiary. God, it was great. You active in that deal? Oh, yeah. Real active. Got a sponsor and everything. Who's your sponsor? Can't tell you. Nope. Can't tell you. It's an anonymous program, you know. But a lot like the guy that spoke. You know, he was doing good and he got drunk. He lost his wife, lost his family, kept drinking, man. He wrote hot checks, lost his business, went to the penitentiary for all kinds of legal problems. Spent 3 years in the penitentiary, never did take, kept getting drunk. Finally ended up in the state mental hospital. That's my sponsor. And I listened to every word he says. Think about who your sponsor is, you know? Why do you tell somebody you listen to your sponsor, what your sponsor is, they think, why do you do that? He's crazy. Yep, he is. I love him. How's that work? Don't know. But it does. It's a miracle that it does, and you can't explain it. And we think that we're going to take this program and we're going to get so refined that we're going to be able to educate people to where they don't have to drink anymore. We're going to teach them that they have a lot of disorders. And these disorders, I tell you what, I moved to Dallas in 83. How much time have I got? 15 minutes. Okay, we're going to talk fast, so listen fast. I moved to Dallas in 83. And in 83, I moved by UPS. That's what happened. I'd been sleeping in my car, and then I threw a rod through the engine, and so I sold my car for $500, and I moved, I hitchhiked from Reno, Nevada. I called UPS. I boxed everything I owned in 3 boxes. UPS came and shipped it to my sister in Dallas, Texas. I hitchhiked from Reno, Nevada to Salt Lake City because you could fly for $99 one way, and I flew to Dallas, Texas, February 1 of 83, and I've been in Dallas ever since. I got a sponsor in Dallas, took my third step, my fourth step in Dallas, never took a fourth step in Reno, took my a year and a half sober, about going on 2 years, I took my fourth step in Dallas with my sponsor, and my whole life fell together real quick. Miracles started happening, and I could not believe what was going on in my life, you know? And got married in Dallas, a wonderful time, got back in the insurance business in Dallas. Bought a house in Dallas. My whole life came together. Made amends to my ex-wife and got my kids back in Dallas. A few years later, got divorced in Dallas. You know, and that was a very painful process because I didn't know that was going to happen. That wasn't part of the plan of recovery. Now, nobody told me that if you get sober and you get well, you're never going to have any pain in your life. Nobody told me that. But I just assume that if you get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and you practice the program, you're not going to have any pain. Everything's going to be great, you know? And I was on a pink cloud for about 7 years. And when I got divorced, it was a shock. Even though they warn us that the stuff's going to happen, you know? In Chapter 5, they say, in our adventures before and after. That means you're going to have some adventures after you get sober. And so I'm going through this divorce, and I don't know what to do. It was a shock to me. I'm 8 years sober, 9 years sober, and my sponsor says, you got to work with other people. So I started going to a lot of newcomers meetings, sponsoring a lot of newcomers, handing out my business card to these newcomers. When you do that, they start calling you. That's a bad deal. All these newcomers call me on the phone, and I started working with all of them. They'd call me on the phone and say, listen, if you're going to sponsor me, then you're going to have to help me out. You're going to have to know who I am. And I said, well, I'm going to find out who you are. And he said, well, you need to know something, John. I come from a very dysfunctional family. And I said, really? And I said, yes. And because of that, I never had any proper role models to learn how to set proper boundaries. And because of that, I never had any, I have an abandonment issue that I never have been able to resolve, which quite frankly, John, has led to a sexual addiction that's just driving me crazy. I'm exhausted. I'm thinking, we got all kinds of problems here. And they'd come over to my house, and they got all these new things they're reading, you know, these books they're reading and stuff like that. I have no idea. They're on their latest, you know, medication, designer drug that's helping them get through this problem. And I don't know what's going on, but I'm no doctor, so they're doing that. And I got to read this stuff to catch up to date on what they're doing. So I'm reading this literature. I want to tell you, all that stuff that's coming out of the treatment center. Let me tell you what'll happen. You'll relate. That's what'll happen. You're going to relate to it. Because what they've done, it's ingenious. What they've done is they've taken all of our character defects and redefined them as disorders. Okay? Because here's what happens. You don't get paid for treating defects. You get paid for treating disorders. Okay? And what happened about 15 years ago, and I was in the insurance business when it happened, maybe 20 years ago, the insurance companies did a survey, and they found out they're spending $250,000 on alcoholics that keep getting drunk. And they keep sending it. Treatment got up to be $30,000, $40,000 a month. And they were sending these treatment centers, and they would come out, and they'd get drunk in a week. So they sent them back to treatment. Pretty soon they've burned up $250,000. And we keep getting drunk. And they found out that, you know what, the same amount that just walked through the doors of AA get sober that we send to treatment. Percentage is the same. So they redefined what alcoholism in the insurance companies, and they said, we're going to pay $5,000 benefit for alcoholism. Lifetime benefit, $5,000 for mental disorder. Treatment center said, we can't treat it for $5,000. They said, that's what we're going to pay. We're going to pay $5,000 for mental disorders, for alcoholism. So they said, okay, $5,000. How about depression? Will you pay $5,000 for depression? Oh, yeah, we'll pay $5,000 for depression. Okay, now we're up to $10,000. How about anxiety disorder? Can we pay $5,000 for anxiety disorder? Yeah, we'll pay $5,000 for disorder. So now they got $15,000. So all those disorders, they get paid for. Okay? Now, you don't believe me? If you've been in treatment in the last 10 years, if you got out of treatment, you had more than one problem, didn't you? Because they don't get paid for one problem. In order to get paid for anything, you got to have a lot of problems. That's what happened. You like it or not, I don't care. That's the reality that it is. Because when I went to treatment, you came out with one problem. You came out an alcoholic. Today, you come out with a bunch of problems. You know, because that's the only way they get paid for it, is they build it different ways. And so they're coming into me, and they're talking about all this stuff, and I don't know any different. They keep getting drunk. I'm letting them do this stuff. They're trying to get their anger management going. They got anger management courses they're going to. They're beating pillows. They're beating stuff up with this little rubber bat and getting their anger out, and I don't understand any of that stuff. And they keep getting drunk on me. And my program, I go to my sponsor. I'm getting sicker and sicker and sicker. I'm trying to recover. I'm getting sicker. My life's more unmanageable now than it was when I got in. I go to my sponsor and I said, listen, I'm going nuts. My program is not working. My program's not working. He looked at me and said, why don't you try ours? And then he asked me some key questions. He said, John, let me ask you a question. How many guys under a year are you sponsoring? I said, 14. He said, any of them getting well? I said, no, I'm getting sick. And he said, are you passing on to them the same program of AA that was passed on to you? And I wasn't. See, they wouldn't let me do that crap when I was here. They loved me enough to stand on my toes and say, you know what? That has nothing to do with your disease. You may have that problem, but we deal with alcoholism. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And here's what we do for that. Till you get that fixed, don't mess with that other thing. You know? They love me that much. They love me enough to have me hate them because they hurt my feelings. that he loved me enough to hurt my feelings to save my life. And so I had to go to those guys and make amends and tell them, you know what? I don't know how to do what you're doing. I don't know how to recover with that program you got. I only know one program of recovery, and that's the program that's passed on to me, and that's what I'm responsible for. And I don't want anybody to leave tonight and not know the program that's passed on to me, because that's what I'm responsible for. And guys, I know how tough it is when you've been sober a while and you're sitting in a meeting and you hear people get off on these tangents about what their therapist has them doing and how they're dealing with their anger management or their abandonment issue or their depression or whatever it is they're doing. And you bring something up and they look at you like you're the outcast. You know, you're the one that's off. Bill Wilson would never kick us out, you know, and all that. I know how bad that is, how tough that is to do that. But you know what? I'm responsible to pass on the program that's passed on to me. And the program that's passed on to me doesn't say a damn thing that I have to deal with any issues in any fashion whatsoever. I don't have to do that. In fact, the program that's passed on to me says, John, you can't do it. If you could have dealt with your issues, you'd have done it 25 years ago. And you wouldn't be in AA today. The very fact that you can't deal with your issues is why you're here. See, we're going to teach you how to surrender. And there's a big difference from surrender to dealing with my issues. I'm going to give that stuff up. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to control that stuff. So I have to surrender that stuff to a power greater than myself that's going to solve my problem. I don't call my sponsor to learn how to manage my life better. I call him to learn how to surrender my life to a power greater than me. Because it's that power that's going to fix me. This, that sounds real simplistic. Ain't nothing simplistic about it. I have a disease that is so complicated and so intense that only God himself can free me from it. It is that bad a disease. I've got to have that God. Well, okay, John, maybe there's a God. And maybe he created the world. But God's not personally going to take care of you. He's not personally going to help you like that. You know, you got to do your own stuff. That's why I put doctors down here. You know? Maybe it's just a coincidence that things work out for you sometimes. You know? A lot of stuff's just a coincidence. I'm sitting there in my home group, Dallas North, back in Dallas, Texas. I'm 2 years sober. I'm at Dallas North. Big group, 200 people. Birthday night. Got 200 people at birthday night. It goes on for 4 hours, birthday night. I'm leaving, getting ready to go home after birthday night. It's 11 o'clock at night. Joanne's working at the front desk. Joanne says, hey, a little lady called from San Antonio. Her son's drinking, and he's suicidal, going to shoot himself tonight. You want to take this 12-step call? And I said, not really. You know, he's got a gun. I don't want to go over there. But let me talk to his mom. So I called the mom, talked to her. She said, my son's suicidal. I'm down in San Antonio. I can't get there. He called me. He's been to AA, but he's suicidal, and he couldn't find AA's phone number. He's real disoriented. He's been drinking and drugging for 2 weeks, been up for 2 weeks. But he could remember his mama's phone number. He said, will you call him and see if you can help him? I can't get up there in time. He's going to shoot himself. But he wants some help. So I called him on the phone, told him who it was. I said, you want me to come help you? He said, yeah, I do. I'm not going to make it tonight. I've been up for two weeks, speeding and drinking, and I just can't go anymore. I'm going to kill myself. He said, what's your address? We'll come get you. He said, I can't. Then he started back. I said, you know what? I can't even tell you how to get here. I'm too disoriented. I said, well, give me your address. We'll find it. He said, you won't be able to find me. It's not even on Mapsco, you know. It's just a street 2 blocks long. It's a brand new street. Only been here a year. It's not on the new maps. You can't find me. I can't tell you how to get here. I'm too messed up. I said, give me your address. We'll find you. Lived on Dome Street. I've told this story every year for 23 years in Dallas, Texas. Every group, every month I tell this story somewhere, some group in Dallas. There's thousands of drunks. And I always ask them, does anybody here know where Dome Street is? Not one time in 23 years has anybody raised their hand. It's a little street 2 blocks long. But say, I know where Dome Street is. I knew right where it was. I said, I know right where you are. I have a client that lives on Dome Street. He not only lives on Dome Street, he is literally the next door neighbor, the guy making the phone call. I said, I know right where you are. I'll be there in 5 minutes. I grabbed Tom that I sponsored. We went over there and made that 12-step call. That's just a coincidence, isn't it? Little lady calls from San Antonio, calls information, asks for AA. We got 100 groups in Dallas. For some reason, the operator gives them Dallas North. I'm at Dallas North. I'm 2 years sober, 200 drunks at the meeting. But for some reason, Joanne gives me that 12-step call, and I know where Dome Street is. You know the odds of that? I'm a gambler, right? Well, y'all want to bet on that. That'll happen a lot. You know, That's just a coincidence. God's not going to do that. God's not going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives, since God works through people. You know, it's just a coincidence, isn't it? A little while after that, I'm going on an airplane to California on business. I get out there, plane's been canceled. But they come on and they say, listen, there's a plane two gates down going to California. Maybe you can go on that. Well, 100 of us are now put our name on the list. I'm the there are only 17 seats left. I'm the last guy on the list, second to last guy. Let me on the plane. There's one seat. This one you can smoke on airplanes. There's one seat in the smoking section. I go back there. There's a gal, good-looking gal in a red dress. I'll never forget that, sitting there. And there's one next to her is the window seat. It's open. I looked at her and I thought, God is working in my life today, you know? So I sat down. This is a bad seat, though. She's a chatterbox. She's just chatter, 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 chatter. I have not had enough coffee for this woman, you know? So she's chattering away. Finally, the airplane takes off. She shuts up. She pulls out a needle point. She's needle pointing. I look over. She's needle pointing the Serenity Prayer. I thought, my turn. So what are you doing? She says, I'm just needle pointing. I said, I know, but what are you needle pointing? She don't want to show me. She finally pulls it up. She says, well, they call it the Serenity Prayer. I said, oh, man, are you one of those Jesus freaks? She said, no. Now she's going real fast. She knows I'm watching her. Her hands are sweaty, you know. And she said, but I'm trying to lead a spiritual life. And I said, really? She said, yeah. So I'm watching her. I thought, I better stop this poor gal before she breaks a finger, you know. So I stopped her. I said, honey, listen, if that's the Serenity Prayer and you try to lead the spiritual life, are you a friend of Bill Wilson's? And boy, she stopped inside and she said, yeah. Are you? I said, no. She gets a funny look on her face, and I said, he died years before I got sober. You know, he just really did, you know. Come to find out, this gal had just a few weeks or a couple years sober. This was her first trip away from Dallas, and she'd had her first drunk dream the night before. And so I said, you know, she thought that was a premonition she was going to get drunk. I said, no big deal. So I told her about my drunk dreams, gave her some names of people in California. We had a great story. She cried, I cried. She said, can you believe this? I was sitting up in the non-smoking section, and they announced you were coming on. God had me move back here, sit by you. Can you believe God would do that? I said, hell, he canceled my whole plan to get me to come over here and sit by you. Yeah, you know, that's just a coincidence. God ain't going to do that. He's not going to cancel a plane so you can make a 12-step call, is he? That's just a coincidence. God's not going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information, is he? That's just a coincidence. You know, and I say that because right now I know in this meeting tonight there's some people here that are scared. And you don't know. You don't know. I could tell those stories all night long about what God's done for me. But there's people here that are scared, and you don't know whether God loves you enough or whether there's something else going on. Do I need to do something else? It's like you've crawled. You're in a lot of pain, man. You've crawled over there to the precipice, and you're looking into the abyss, and you don't know. Do I need to do something else? Or does God love me? Is God going to do something for me? If that's where you are, then you need to know that I know tonight more than I ever have that God loves us totally. And he's totally committed to our recovery. In fact, God will go to any lengths to see you get this deal. I used to think that was a one-way street. I used to think that I had to be willing to go to any lengths to get sober. I know that God will go to any lengths to see you get sober. He'll do whatever he has to do to help you, including giving you that moment of clarity. And I don't know when he'll help you, but I know how he's going to help you. What God's going to do is he's going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in your lives. Because God works through people. And that's what we do in here is we keep that moment alive by working with each other. And I love you and thank you for having me come share. Yeah.